This is Stephen Strang. Before my podcast, I want to give my listeners a special offer of getting 2 years of Charisma Magazine for only $20. This is better than two for one. I hope you want Charisma in your home, where you can read it, where you can share, where you can keep it around the house and sometimes look at an article later. You know, with everything that's happening with digital, we have found that people still want Charisma in print. And I've been sharing this in my last few podcasts, and it's interesting that the subscriptions are coming in, and I hope that you'll take advantage of this offer by going to charismamag.com/2, T-W-O. That means 2 years for the price of one for only $20. And now here's my podcast.
Welcome to the Strang Report with Steve Strang on the Charisma Podcast Network. This episode was produced to discuss and address issues within our nation and around the world from a Christian worldview.
The Bible is the most important book ever written. Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Strang, and welcome to the Strang Report. What I just said is something that most of my listeners know. Hopefully, we need to read it. We need to make it a part of our lives. We need to hide it in our hearts. But most of you know that a little over a year ago, an amazing new museum opened up in Washington, D.C. It's the Museum of the Bible. I've been there only once, but it is magnificent. And as I say on the podcast today, every Christian needs to figure out a way to get to Washington to see this museum. It is in walking distance of the mall, and in my opinion, it's every bit as good as anything that the Smithsonian Institution has to offer the museum goer. Everyone probably knows that the Green family of Hobby Lobby are the ones behind it, and it's a wonderful story and a wonderful vision. Recently, the man who the Greens brought in, Carrie Summers, visited my office, and I said, I want to do a podcast about this museum. We've written about it in Charisma Magazine. In fact, we made it the cover story the month that the museum opened. But I wanted you to hear from Carrie the story behind it, how all this came together, and also to get a little flavor of his personality and his background. I told him that he's one of the most interesting people I've ever met, and I hope you enjoy my interview with Carrie Summers of the Museum of the Bible. Carrie Summers, you have one of the most interesting jobs, I think, maybe in the world. You were involved with the founding. In fact, you were the first president of the Museum of the Bible in Washington. Tell us about it.
Well, I have a lot of friends saying I just would like to carry your bags with you where you travel. Because when we started the Museum of the Bible, we started from zero, truly, was just an idea. And everything that got built started in basically in December of 2010. So from 2010, when the organization was formed, legally formed, and we opened the museum in Washington, D.C. in November of 17, and it's the fourth largest.
On time.
On time, fourth largest museum in Washington, 430,000 square feet. That surprised a lot of people, that we could go from zero to that in that shorter period of time and do it at a level of excellence that's been recognized by third parties. We can always say it, but we've had so many now different awards given on the excellence of the museum that it was quite an accomplishment. But we also know that our attorneys that we had did not believe this statement, but we always said God is going before us on this, and they finally realized it when we got through some very difficult hearings with 100% yes votes, which they had never seen before. So we could say, yeah, we built it record time, but really God went before us on it.
Well, let's talk about that. I've had the privilege of being there just once. I heard it was magnificent, so I planned a day, an entire day. I understand it takes, isn't it like, it takes several days to go through it if you look at everything.
Right. Nine 8-hour days. Which we've had people try, by the way, and in every case they said they did not get finished. So it may be more than that.
Well, I got a good overview kind of picked and choose what I wanted to see, and I look forward to coming back. It is in a historic building that was a warehouse. Apparently it was a refrigerated warehouse. It's been several things. I was interested in that part of it, remodeled it, and it's just a magnificent, and it's must-see. Everybody has got to figure out a way to get to Washington, D.C. to see Museum of the Bible because, of course, the Bible is the greatest book ever written.
Yeah, even for people that don't have the same appreciation of the Bible as maybe a Catholic and Protestants and Jews might have, they still have found the building to be fascinating and the beauty of it, but also the content, because what we learned is people are they're not, in many cases, they're not opposed to the Bible. They simply know nothing about it, and their neutrality is sometimes interpreted as opposition. And we're finding that in most cases, that's not the case. They simply don't know anything. And the Museum of the Bible is at all different levels. You can come in and go whatever level you wish. And it allows them in a non-threatening environment, highly engaging in this 430,000 square feet, it allows them to learn at their level. And they walk away informed. They're not quite, let's say they're not sold over, nor are we trying to sell anything, but they feel more comfortable now in understanding the Bible a little bit more about it, maybe even starting to read it a little bit. And that was really one of our main objectives, was to create that kind of atmosphere to do that.
Well, of course, the Bible is and always has been a big part of my life, and it's hard for me to understand that, but it seemed to me that it also was a testimony to the Jewish faith, the Christian faith, without, let's say, proselytizing.
Right.
But it was presented very clearly. Right. And there's, of course, antiquities and all kinds of different displays. There's even kind of like a theme park ride.
Right.
There where is. You kind of, it's almost like you're flying all over Washington, seeing all the, scriptures that are in our major buildings there.
Right. You remember well. You're absolutely correct. That was a ride mechanism out of Vienna, Austria. Since we put it in, it's a sensation of flying. But nobody else in the U.S. had it. Now, I think one of the major theme park companies is taking it on now as one of their key new rides in the future. But we did that because so much of the denial going on about the Washington was not founded upon Judeo-Christian principles, and the drumbeat just was getting higher and higher and higher. And we decided to not argue it, but just show people. And quite amazing when you do that. You know, you're not picking sides. You're just saying, here's the facts. And that's what we tried to do throughout the museum, the founding of America based on the Bible. We have a whole section. Again, we're not trying to dispute anybody, but we're saying, well, here's the real facts. Here's the writings. Here's the letters. Here's the documents. Here's the Bibles. And you make up your own mind. All we're going to do is show you the evidence. And that's what the whole museum's about.
And on top of the museum, I remember you have a magnificent theater.
Right.
And I stayed and watched a Broadway-style musical, and it was just magnificent.
That was Amazing Grace. Thank you. It was a huge hit. And by popular demand, truly, we're bringing it back, and it opens in the theater again, its second season, in 2 weeks. It'll run through mid-August. And it's Amazing Grace, the Broadway show from the Nylander Theater in New York. And it's a story of John Newton, of slave ownership and slavery. And that was his life. And then the other half of that story is God's redemption and his grace and what happens when a person figures that out. And, of course, the finale is the song Amazing Grace.
Oh, I mean, it made the hair stand up in your arms.
Doesn't it? I saw that show, I can't tell you how many times, and there wasn't one time that people were not on their feet, and you could feel as in the industry would say, you could feel the roof is going to get blown off. And every night it did. People just it built up to such a crescendo that people were just exuberant, clapping, crying out, people crying as they left. And it wasn't out of sadness. It was out of the overwhelming joy that show ended with the redemption story through a man that they got to know through this play of not a good guy at all, and what happened to him. And it's an amazing, amazing, amazing performance, and we're delighted that it's coming back.
Well, I followed this since 2010 when you started, of course. We've reported on it many ways. We did a cover story
right.
in Charisma the month that it opened.
Right.
And I've had the privilege of knowing the Greens for a number of years and was aware of their interest in the Bible. And while all this was going on, you had some kind of traveling display. And I know that you took it to Havana and different places. And I was in Israel at the Museum of the Book, I think is what they call it.
Bible Land Museum.
Right. Thank you for helping me. Yeah. And it's from the Jewish perspective, and they were showing me around. I was there with their curator, and they were treating me like a VIP. Right. And they take me downstairs, and there's something about the Museum of the Bible. I didn't expect it. Uh-huh. And it was your traveling display.
Right.
And so in that setting, I got a little sneak preview of things to come. And what amazed me was you had a display of John Rogers, the martyr.
Right.
He's the one who translated the Thomas Matthews Bible, and in various ways and at various times, I've told people that I'm a direct descendant of his. So here I was in Jerusalem, not expecting to see it, and I was taking my Jewish friends and saying, hey, come over here and see this about the Thomas Matthews Bible.
Yeah, that was a very unusual one. It's the Bible Land Museum, and the family that started that museum we know fairly well. Amanda Weiss is the daughter-in-law.
She was the one who took me around.
Right. Well, she was the stepdaughter of the founder, and her mom still oversee that museum. And they had talked to us about bringing something to that because they knew we had the traveling exhibits. We had done two at the Vatican by that time, and then one in Cuba had been done, and then, of course, the U.S. And they said, why don't you bring one here? And, you know, we weren't quite sure. We spent quite a bit of time investigating it. What we ended up with is really, truly one of the prettiest exhibits we've ever built anywhere in the world. It just turned out to be fantastic based upon the people that came in and helped us do it in Israel. And then the discussion was, what do you show in it? And to your good point, they did not want purely a Jewish exhibit at all. They wanted an exhibit that certainly incorporated the, you know, the Torah, which we did well, and other Jewish writings, Maimonides, so forth. But they also wanted it to be an exposure for the Jewish market, which is primarily who comes to that museum, to understand more about what you might call the Protestant faith in a way. And that's how we built that, and it was ended up being a home run.
It was very exciting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Greens started collecting some antiquities.
Right.
And then it just kind of slowly grew. And it's like, what are we going to do with this? Are we going to show anybody?
Right,
Tell me how that all happened.
Well, it was there were two guys in Dallas, Texas that had an idea of building a big Bible museum. There are hundreds of Bible museums around the world, so it's not unique at all. But to do one that on a scope and a impact scale of a Smithsonian, nobody had ever done that. And they came to the Greens to see if they would help underwrite a building, if they could ever find one in Dallas, and which the Greens have done in the past. And they started on the venture trying to find a building, which did not work out. But the idea, the concept was, we might call it a noble concept. The two people there did not work well. But the idea was that maybe we should do this. So the Green family took it on. The collection of the items started with the idea that they would buy a few items to give to these guys in Dallas as some of their first items. That was it. The Greens are not collectors. But the timing was in 2009 when the market had collapsed and money was, you know, as scarce as could be because of the subprime, you know, the lending rate debacle. And items, if you buy one, it instantly gets out that, oh, there's a new buyer in the market. And that's what happened. It was probably wouldn't happen today, but back then it did. It became a big deal. And so many, many items started being presented to the Green family. And they thought, well, okay, we'll buy a few more, and that'll give them a little better start on their museum. And then before they knew it, they had a lot of things, as they said, in their closet. And then the deal in Dallas did not work out. So they said, let's do something with them. They did not want them. They were not a collector, so they just want them sitting around. So they created a traveling exhibit, and that's what started traveling the U.S. And then it was very, very popular, and then it started traveling into the first one overseas was the Vatican by their invitation because they had heard what was going on. And then it got into Cuba a couple times, and then it went into Germany, and then it went into Argentina and Israel. And so it started moving throughout the world. We found that it was highly received everywhere it went. And, you know, that by then you realize, you know what, a big museum, that probably would work because we saw it in living color that it was doing that.
How did you get involved?
Well, in 2010, the idea of creating a travel exhibit was a dream to do that. And one of the people that had helped the Greens find the original items that they bought knew me from Nazareth Village. I built Nazareth Village in Nazareth, Israel.
Which is a wonderful place. I've been there.
Well, thank you.
And you actually kind of get the feel of what Nazareth must have been like in Jesus' day.
Right. It's the only thing in Israel that recreates under historical land with real animals, real sheep, real goats, real homes that were recreated on historical land that was farmland in Nazareth. And I started that in 1998, and we opened in 2000. And it became a draw for a lot of academics because they realized there were some major academics we had brought in to help create it, and they wanted to see what it looked like. And I happened to meet one of these people that ended up helping the Greens, and he knew me from those days. But back then also I was taking on projects at the encouragement of Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade, which told me I should start building things that would attract people who would never step into a church. And I took on several different things, not by design, they just happened. And one of them was traveling artifacts from Hebrew University into the U.S., and nobody had ever done that, biblical artifacts on a travel. So when the Greens had the idea they'd like to do something under traveling exhibit, they called, and I went over and talked to them, and they had been talking to a few other people, and they said, "You've got the best ideas." And I said, "Well, if you want to do it, then just let me know." I was not really trying to sell them on doing it. I was really just trying to help them, advise them on what I'd learned in the years of traveling exhibits. And then one thing led to another, so I ended up helping them built it out. And then they needed help on, well, how do you run one of these? And so I lent my experience to that. And then, well, how do you supervise one of these? And, you know, it's a typical story. It's the boiling frog story, you know, before you know it, you're all in, and you weren't planning to be all in.
But you have a very interesting background that must have prepared right. you in some ways for this.
It did.
You were telling me a little bit about it.
Yeah.
Abercrombie and Fitch and Bass Pro Shop.
Right, right.
What is your background?
Well, it's basically that. I started out extremely young, bought my first car when I was 15 years old. Our family had virtually no money, from Odessa, Texas. And it was not, but that wasn't unusual. I mean, kids back then, that was just the way of life. And, you know, today people gasp when you say you were working almost full-time at 13. But that was not unusual at all. And I enjoyed it greatly. I was quite good in retail. So I ended up working my way through school and doing retail and retail sporting goods. And because I'm a math major with physics, and I can remember, you know, stock keeping units, and there were no computers back then. So if you could remember numbers, you were like a walking computer back then, and it worked out well. So anyway, I was with a company that bought Abercrombie & Fitch and out of bankruptcy, which I ended up overseeing until we sold it. And then a friend of mine asked if I could help him develop a multi-store chain concept of sporting goods, and that was John Morse with Bass Pro, and that's how I got to Springfield, Missouri. And then another friend wanted to retire as CEO of a company, theme park company, number 6 in the world in size, and that was called Hershen Family Entertainment. Back in those days, it was called Silver Dollar City Corporation, owns Dollywood and Branson Properties. And then I've had an encounter with a fellow named Bill Bright, and Bill's the one that said, you should retire from that and start building things that would attract people that won't go into a church. And for some reason, it just hit me, and I think God showed us that was the direction, and so I did. And I started a company that started building things that would attract people that wouldn't go into a church. And that was 25 years ago now, almost. And that's how that came about with the Green family. And this was by far the biggest thing we had ever taken on. And again, we were not planning to build a museum this fast. It just happened that we said, let's go and see if there's what the world has out there. We didn't know. And we found this property after a couple of years in Washington, D.C. It was not the ideal property at all because it was an old warehouse, beat up, ugly. Joseph Kennedy had bought it years ago and made it an international design center. And it was owned by a company by then that needed cash for, they were a public traded company, they needed to sell something. They had two or three properties up for sale, and they were very negotiable at that point. And we said, you know, let's throw our hat in the ring and see what happens. And we got it. I mean, it was, again, if we had not gotten it, I don't think anybody would have lost any sleep, but we just said, let's see what happens. If this is what God wants us and the timing is, he'll either make it happen or he won't. Well, it did. And we bought that building in July of 12, and if it's still today the only building that close to the mall that has become available. We thought there surely would be a better building available, but we went ahead and risked it, and sure enough, it's the only one that was. So that's how we got the building, and then we just said, let's figure out how to build this thing, get it open. We just felt a very high sense of urgency, and we started that building, and 24 hours a day, once we started, we never stopped. Three shifts a day, 24 hours a day, and we built in half the time of any museum ever that size has been built in Washington.
Well, it's magnificent, and people need to go see it. And, of course, you had to keep the outside looking like it's a historic facade.
Right.
And it actually used to have a railroad track that went right through it.
Right.
So you had this great opening, which became your grand entrance.
Right.
And then I looked at all the exhibits on the wall, and it's like you took out every other floor.
Right, exactly right.
Except on the second floor where there's a magnificent coffee shop.
Right.
Which became
right
my main place to hang out if I wanted to take a little break. Yeah. And, I mean, it was just brilliant on how all this stuff happened and and a subway stop underneath.
Right.
I mean, you could really see the hand of God in everything there.
Yeah, the brick building, great story. It's an ugly red brick building. And there's limits on how much...
Well, it's not ugly anymore.
Well, it was. It was at the time. And there was limitations on how much of the brick you could replace because of the historical nature. The building, being 100 years old, had 9 different shades of red brick. And it just, brick would fall out, they'd put a new one in, and, you know, it was real hodgepodgey of reds. And we had the ability to remove certain portions if we wished. And it was a big decision, not only cost-wise, but just the whole idea. And we chose not to. And we got a lot of negative feedback right off the bat before we opened, that we had a chance to make a beautiful red brick building, and we left it with this ugly old red brick building. Since then, the museum has won several awards, from the best restoration to ever, the reuse of a building ever, da-da-da. And it's won many, many awards because that old red brick. But now with the beautiful roof that we have, which is all glass, and that patchy reddish brick, it is now high kudos from designers saying, how in the world did you create that? You know, our answer is we didn't do anything. We just left it alone. And it represents the Bible in us because the Bible has been beat up. It's the most banned book in the world, most debated book, the most burnt book, the most destroyed book, and it's ragged, and it survived. And it was almost like this red brick building. It was ragged, not very pretty, but it survived to do a magnificent thing, to house this Bible museum. And it just hit us that we were much like the people that God describes in the Bible. Is beat up and, you know, just looking to be made anew, so to speak. And the red brick building represented that. And none of this hit us at the time. You know, it was pretty mechanical decisions we were making, except that decision. That decision, we got it, we believe, by inspiration to not change it. And now it's the kudo of the museum industry on how we created this look of an old, old museum. And of course, you would want that because it's the oldest book in the world that we're representing.
That's interesting. And this first year has been very successful by almost every measure. Tell us what's happened the first year in terms of how many people have come. And I think there's a transition in leadership.
Yes, we had 1 million people our first year, which is one, you know, makes us one of the biggest attended museums in Washington. And it was an interesting year because we are asked constantly, what were the biggest surprises? Surprise number one was the number of young people who came and are still coming. And these are young people who get on the subway, and they're old enough to ride the subway, and they come over, and they pay their admission to get in, and they could go to anywhere else, but they're coming to the Bible Museum and thoroughly enjoying it. And it's over and over and over, and school groups coming back over and over. They enjoy it. It's a great hangout. The second is we survey people online and there at the museum and other electronic mechanisms in the museum is, how does this museum make you feel, or how does the Bible make you feel? Just curious. And the number one answer that we have gotten still today is, it gives me hope. And with such a diverse group of people coming in, being every faith tradition has been there, over 100 countries have visited, the number one answer is hope. So what it shows you is people, no matter where they're coming from, they're all looking for hope. No matter what your faith is, hope is the number one issue. And so those surprised us a little bit. That, you know, we didn't build either one to be a kid mecca or a teen mecca, and certainly the word hope was not in our vocabulary and what we were trying to accomplish. So that's been very, very interesting. And with that, we've learned a great deal. We're not changing much in the museum, but we are changing, bringing in really exciting traveling exhibits from other institutions. We have some beautiful ones coming up in 2019 and 2020, and fantastic. You will not be able to see, you travel the world, and you're not going to be able to see everything that you see in this museum. And the other thing we learned is with the Vatican Museum and Library being there, and with their own space, and then the Israel Antiquity Authority out of Israel, their own space, those are both highly attended areas because you can go to Israel and you're never going to see those items, and you're going to go to the Vatican and you cannot get into the Vatican Library unless you're a very high-end scholar, and you can come into ours and see these. And we're the first museum to do that under long-term agreements, and it has really worked well, and people have loved it.
I was interested in the exhibit from Israel. It seems to me it had something to do with proving that King David lived.
Right. That was one of them.
And so I go in there, and I don't really know what it is. And I'm going like, why are they trying to prove King David? He's all over the Bible. He's, right. You know, probably my favorite Old Testament character. But then I realized that they were coming from a secular point of view of, can we prove that a source other than the Bible, right, that some of these people existed? And the answer was yes.
Yes, and it's a great question. Boy, that's a great statement. Because, you know, if we're Protestants or Catholics or Jews, we somewhat live in a bubble a little bit. And the big chunk of the world, they don't believe the Bible is real. They may be accepted as a piece of literature, but they want proof. We're in a more skeptical world today than we've ever seen. And they want proof of it. Now, archaeology cannot prove the Bible, but it can support the Bible. And that one particular find was at Tel Dan, and it had David's name listed there. It's the only evidence ever found in Israel that David existed, even today. But it was, and there it was. And did Jerusalem exist? Well, we have a copy of one of the great, called steles. These are giant monuments that are engraved from Egypt there. And it talks about Israel in existence in 1208 B.C. So people think that Israel is a modern thing. That's not true. So what it's doing is, if people will take time and walk through and read, I think that's one of the great fun part of touring this museum is to, no matter where you're at in your faith walk, it doesn't matter if you have 3 PhDs, you're going to find something in that museum that you did not know, but it's so large. It's got over 70 hours of content. You can easily miss it. So we've now put in electronic docents. You key in what you want to see. It'll give you a GP. It's geofencing. It knows where you are within 5 inches. So you can maximize your time on seeing things. It'll take you right within 5 inches of the item or the topic you want. And that way you can have a fighting chance to get through some of the museum each visit. And that's a new invention we put in.
So tell us what the future is, because the museum is there, it's finished, hopefully there for generations to come,
right. Millions
of visitors exposed to the Word of God.
Right.
But what other things is the Museum of the Bible doing?
Well, first of all, we've brought in a new CEO, wonderful fella, Ken McKenzie. Comes from a different industry, but a brilliant thinker. And we've brought in some additional team members because the team that built the museum, sometimes that takes a little different mindset than the one to operate one. And very different skill sets, but also just a different reason for being. No question, we had an incredible team to build it. Proof is there. We don't have to brag about it. We just go see it. And now we're structuring the team that can push it down the road into even to a higher level. And so that's going extremely well. It's given a lot of opportunities. Some new people come in, and we're still in that process trying to fill, create new positions, new categories. You know, you don't need an outreach one necessarily day one or when you're building, but you do now. And so these different categories have done, and we're trying to reemphasize the whole education part of the museum. So that's occurring. So what you're going to see coming down the road is you're going to see some incredible and come to some incredible lectures. And you can do this online. You can watch them online. One that we'll be launching rather quickly, a whole series on faith, the Bible, and statesmanship. And our first one is going to be, we're going to take on George Washington under that topic. And so you can go online and watch these live on Facebook Live. And we're creating a whole series of these now. So the museum is moving more into that realm. Obviously, there's no substitute coming in and looking at the museum. But if you can't, then tune in on these lectures and symposiums that we're doing because they're incredibly creative. The best of the best in the world are going to be speaking during these things. That starts in about 2 or 3 weeks, and they're going to run all the way through the summer. And then we'll put a new line out for the fall. So that's something brand new. We're also bringing in some major new exhibits that will be coming in, and that'll be coming in starting this fall. And again, they will run all the way through next year, usually 1 year runs, 6 months, and then we switch out and so forth. So it's different categories. We're going to be bringing one in from Amsterdam, from the Hebrew, from the Jewish Museum in Amsterdam, that deals with Passover. What is Passover, and what is that real story about? And so nobody's really taking that on in a big way, and we're going to be having a great special exhibit to where maybe even we would have some kosher Orthodox leadership that would even have the ability to come and have a Passover meal at the museum. It's some things that like that would be going on. So it's not only just the museum for what it is today, but we can subsidize it with 6 different exhibits at one time going on, all very different. And they're quite exciting. They're just fantastic. And some you'll never see again because they were created for us by other people, and they're using the museum to launch them. And so that's something that people can go online, watch for that coming down the pike at us. And then also more of our education suites will be more available, and people can come in, sign up, come in and spend a week at a symposium. And we're going to be making more of that offer also available. So the museum will become more of a living and breathing than just a stagnant come in and see what we got and go back home. Becomes highly engaging that way. That's something we're working hard at.
Well, that's exciting. As we wrap this up, I'm going to give you the last word on anything else we haven't talked about that you think's important.
Well, you know, in 10 years of getting this thing done, we have still a lot to talk about and to share. I would say the number one thing that we've learned is that people, no matter who you are, there is a high need to continue to learn about the Bible. You may not think so, but when you come into the museum, it's those aha moments. Wow, I didn't know that. And we're trying to fill those aha moments in for whatever level you are. And we'll be coming out with an online museum shortly. There'll be a new announcement coming up, seeing sort of tour from home. And so we're trying to bring the museum, take it globally as fast as we can and allow people to engage, which is in truly the most exciting, I'm going to call it a piece of literature, book ever written. There's no other book ever that's been written. And for those of us who believe that it is the inspired word of God, it's even more incredible then. But for all people, no matter where you are, it is the greatest read you will ever read.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Cary Summers, and I hope that you will make it a point to visit the Museum of the Bible. Of course, you can go online and check out their website and get kind of an overview, but it doesn't come close to the real museum. If you don't already subscribe to my Strangleport newsletter, I invite you to do so. It's a way that you can get the podcast delivered to your mailbox and also kind of a write-up about the podcast itself. It's very easy to do. All you do is send an email to newsletter.strangreport.com. I'll repeat it. It's newsletter.strangreport, as if it's one word, .com. We also have a new line where you can call in and leave your comments. We would use some of them in our letters to the editor section in Charisma if they're appropriate, or I'm going to actually put together a podcast in the future with some of the phone calls that come in. That number is 407-706-8476. The nice thing about a podcast is you can back it up and play it again. Thank you for listening to the podcast today. I hope you share it with your friends, and I hope you tune in again for another edition of The Strang Report on the Charisma Podcast Network. I'm Stephen Strang. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to The Strang Report with Steve Strang. To read more from Steve, visit his blog, The Strang Report, on charismamag.com. Again, it's The Strang Report on charismamag.com.
This has been a production of the Charisma Podcast Network. Steve and Joyce Strang are the founders and owners of CPN. Dr. Steve Green is the executive producer of the Charisma Podcast Network. We intend to honor God with every podcast and remain thankful to our advertisers and supporters who make these podcasts possible.